sell commercial advertising. So we are very thankful for those who help keep our programming in force by sponsoring our programs. And I'd like to thank my sponsor today, Swiss America Trading, which is a great company out of Arizona, and it makes a market in tangible precious metals, which is which what that means is they make a market in gold coins, silver coins, platinum coins, and other types of investment bullion. So if you're thinking about adding tangible precious metals to your portfolio, you might want to give them a call at 1-800-519-6271 and ask them to send you some free information, or you can go to their website, SwissAmerica.com, and you can shop around on their website. And if something catches your eye or you'd like free information, you can use the promo code EASTMAN, which stands for Eastman Financial Report. You type in EASTMAN and they will be happy to send you information. And there are also some valuable discounts available. Right now, Swiss America Trading is offering bullion coins at the very low price of $13.50 each. And they'll ship them to you with no shipping. It would be free shipping to your home or your business. And that's a really great deal. Thinking about what to get your Uncle Joe or somebody who's a little bit difficult to buy a gift for during the gift giving season, you might find that those coins are a great bargain. And there's something that people will tend to not throw away when they're it. People tend to keep precious metals because they are, in fact, precious. So if you're looking for a gift-giving idea or you're interested in expanding your holdings of tangible precious metals, give Swiss America a call, 1-800-519-6271. Go to their website, use the promo code EASTMAN, and take advantage of that offer. Now, the offer is only available until they run out, so I wouldn't wait too long if you're thinking about these as a gift item or an investment. And also, there's a limit of 250 coins per person at that price. So you might want to think about that. Go to their website and check it out. It's certainly worth worth your efforts to do so. Okay, we'd like to thank Swiss America for their sponsorship, not only of this program, but also of WVW-TV. Okay, let's jump into the news today. There's quite a bit going on from the economy's perspective. There's a lot happening. Of course, we have the Federal Open Market Committee. The Federal Reserve Group is meeting November 1st and 2nd to take a look at the national economy and to decide whether they're going to increase the interest rates again, or if they're going to hold them flat again, or if they're going to actually cut them. And it's all the prognosticators are out, of course, and some say they'll crank it up another quarter of a don't know until the Federal Reserve meets. And of course, what the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee does is they tend to look at the news, and that's why there's a lot of conflicting news in the marketplace. I was looking over the weekend and trying to get a bigger, broader macro. And it's hard to do because there's a lot of reason to put information out to manipulate the Federal Open Market Committee and impact their decisions, or at least nudge them decision. And that's why a lot of the media that you see tends to be rather confusing, because it's not necessarily painting a clear picture of the American economy. And let me give you an example of that. Real growth in GDP, gross domestic product, it's reported up, it has gone up 4.9% in the third quarter ended September 30th. So that's a strong indicator that the national economy is 4.9%. That's certainly not in recession territory, and two negative quarters in a row of GDP would indicate a recession. Well, the quarter before, I think, was reported out at 3.8%, and now it's up 4.9. That's over 1%. So what it suggests is that the economy is still buzzing along quite nicely, and from the Federal Open Market Committee's perspective, that would indicate and of course, we know that the inflation rates, as reported earlier, last couple of weeks, is showing a 4% increase, 4.2% of food, net of fuel and food, and about 3.8% overall. So interestingly, what we're seeing is very conflicting numbers that are not giving a clear picture of where the U.S. economy is headed, and I think that's a problem because a lot of this is filtered through the lens of an election year coming up, and of course the incumbent administration wants everything to look great and the economy's booming. And of course, the challenger wants the economy to be in the tank so you can run against that and use it as a wedge issue. But the reality is we, the people sitting on the ground here, are trying to make sense of what's going on in the economy. And then you start to see other metrics and indicators that suggest that the economy is not doing as well as these numbers would project. And let me give you an example of that. As we know, the 12 Federal Reserve regions around the country, part of their job, the non-monetary job, their economic analytics job, is to sample and test the economics within their region to try and get a sense of how that region's economy is doing. Because the United States is a big place, and certainly the West Coast has one type of an economy, and the upper Midwest has a different kind of economy, and the New England area, and the middle states, and the South, and Florida. The United States isn't homogenous with respect to economic activity. There's a lot of variables, and certainly, Sunbelt places tend to be warmer, and their populations are growing, and the economies are stronger. The colder northern places like the upper Midwest and the Great Plains and up into New England, they tend to be older areas, and people aren't moving here, they're moving south. So at the end of the day, the economies aren't homogenous. So you're going to get different reads in different parts of the country. And one of the things that's really interesting is the Dallas Fed has reported, they do their analytics, and for the 18th month in a row, the numbers are coming out negative, minus 19, minus 17. And effectively, what they're sensing is that the consumers in Texas, and that's in the South, and that's a booming state, are really in shock. There's just so much hitting the American consumer, or at least the Texas consumer, and because of the student loans are kicking in, the interest rates are high, the housing market's in the tank, the mortgage rates are high. And at the end of the day, when the Dallas Fed is sampling, and they're coming up with 18 months in a row of negative numbers, and that's not a good sign that suggests that 4.9% growth in GDP is happening. So the question is, those who calculate the GDP number are not the same people. That's the Department of Labor statistics versus the Federal Reserve, which is the monetary side, and it's quasi-governmental. The Federal Reserve Bank is not a government agency. It's quasi-governmental. It's owned by the banks. It's got, the seven governors are appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, but it's much more private sector-y. So you're starting to see numbers that are clashing with the administration's numbers, and boy, the economy is zipping right along. And the regional bank numbers in a hot area of the country, and Texas has always been a growth area, is really showing that the consumers are cooling off. So you try to make sense of those numbers, and it's difficult to do that because the reconciliation isn't dodgy and boring and academic, which is what they were all throughout the 20th century. But there's a political element to this, that in the ability to put out numbers that suggest happy times, good times, growth, when in fact it's not, and then that becomes a different situation. And I guess from the consumer's perspective, or the investor's perspective, or the public's perspective, we want to ask the question is, how good are these numbers, and what are we looking at? And just because we see a headline that says GDP is up 4.9%, yay, what does that mean? And who says that? And who calculated it? And what are the metrics behind it? And where do they get these numbers from? And keep in mind, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, their numbers are adjusted often, like almost every month, and they're always adjusted down. So it creates this splash headline just before the FOMC meeting. And then apparently, you think that the people you're probably the smartest of the smart with respect to financial wizardry. I mean, if you look at, you know, they have PhDs in economics and finance, and you know, you don't rise to the level within the Federal Reserve System by being clueless. I mean, these are the smartest of the smart, so it's hard to believe that they would be, you know, schnookered by Bureau of Labor Statistic headlines. But I think it's a question that we have to ask. And maybe it's not schnookering. Maybe it's a fig leaf thing where effectively you can create camouflage for political action. So it becomes a real problem when the numbers become politicized. And I think from an academic perspective, and from an investment perspective, you'd want to be able to think about these numbers being objective indicators of the economy. And we shall see. We shall see how it plays out. We'll see what effect this has. Will the Federal Reserve raise interest rates by another quarter and try to pull the punch bowl back a little farther from the edge of the table to slow down the party? Or will they ignore it? Or will they read other indicators, hopefully? And we very much shall see what happens. Now, one of the problems with this GDP metric is the concept in and of itself. How do you measure this? And keep in mind, my big ball of the economy, this is the private sector. This is all the businesses and all the people who earn money, you know, for a paycheck or a small business. Everybody in the country who earns a living, and this isn't transfer payments where you take money out and tax to somebody else. You tax the rich, give it to the poor. Those dollars, while they circulate within the economy, those are derivative numbers. So if you take the GDP of the country, which is the private sector generating revenues and income, and you're projecting the growth of that, that becomes a very difficult thing to do, because there are 330 million people in the country, and I don't know how many businesses, you know, millions and millions of businesses. Some operate internationally, some are domestic, but it's a very hard thing to measure the size of that ball because it is so large. And, you know, statisticians and economists do their very best. They'll take metrics and statistical samples and all sorts of clever mathematical tricks to try and estimate. And if you do find a formula and you apply it consistently to the great ball of the economy, ceteris paribus, or, you know, all things remaining equal, the numbers will have some trend that become meaningful to economists and financial people. So if you apply the model the same way over and over and over again to this gigantic spinning ball of economy, you can, in fact, using the same model, it may not be 4.9% growth, it may be 8% or 2% or whatever, but the trend up will be relative, because you will be, however your inferior your mechanism or your formula, it will measure that ball of economic activity consistently, and that's what the trend line looks like. So it becomes difficult then when you see these revisions downward, because you know you'd like to start thinking that, you know, as imperfect as the analytic model is, you'd be able to detect trends going up and trends going down. You may not be able to say 4.2 versus 4.7 or 4.8, but you're going to say, you know, over time, in a relative period of time, you're going to see an increase in the size of the economic ball, or it's going to start shrinks, recession, and then, of course, depression, which is terrible, versus economic growth. And that's really what the whole idea of the Federal Reserve playing around with the size of the ball was, this idea that, you know, if left to its own devices, the ball will just basically inflate or deflate all by itself as the markets hit equilibrium. And if it deflates, depression, it really hurts a lot of people. And if it goes too fast, inflation, which really hurts a lot of people. So they have this idea they can step in. Sort of like Milton Friedman's idea of the velocity of money within that. You're going to slow it down, speed it up. Well, Milton Friedman's monetary policy, that's sort of passe. You know, that was kind of a 1980s thing. But, you know, in the Keynesian model, was basically, you know, a reaction to that, along with, you know, a rarefied Adam Smith model of, in the long run, equilibrium happens. So that's basically what we're looking at. So when we see these numbers, you know, it's not that you should take the headline and run with it, because, you know, many a fool has grabbed the headline and wished they hadn't. And at the end of the day, we're just sitting back watching, because there are just so many indicators that are really not suggesting that we're in a healthy situation. Now, the big news story this morning, of course, is that the United Auto Workers settled with General Motors, and they settled with Ford, and now, you know, with Stellantis, Chrysler. So effectively, it takes the United Auto Workers strike off the table. And this has been about 6 weeks. And of course, the negotiations were for higher wages and better benefits. Why? Because the union members, the unions sensed that inflation last year at 9% was leaving the buying power of organized labor behind. I mean, the buying power was shrinking. And of course, the whole purpose of a union, there's multiple purposes. The big purpose is to make sure that the union workers get a reasonable wage, or a big enough wage. And then benefits are a big issue. And then work can be, and there's a whole bundle of things you negotiate for the betterment of labor, and of course at the expense of capital, which is the factory owners, you know, the company that owns the factory, shareholders. And it's good to see a settlement, because these strikes tend to be very disruptive, not only for the workers who are out of paycheck. Basically, when you go on strike for 6 weeks, it's 6 weeks of no pay. You know, the unions will give you a little stipend, but the reality is it's quite expensive for labor to go on strike. And of course, you know, there's all the apocryphal stories of, you know, the people who run the unions, they don't take a cut in pay, and all the workers are out on the line and they're applying for unemployment and food stamps. But the reality is, labor takes the brunt of strikes. And of course, if you suffer today, and then your future is better during the contract period. From the company's perspective, the strikes can be very costly if you're in a hot market and suddenly you have no ability to produce product into that market. That's a real problem. That's when it hurts. Your profitability craters. In a slow period of time, it's a great time to have a strike. You don't have to pay anybody. You know, you lower your operating costs, and you can preserve your margins. Well, in this particular instance, it's kind of interesting to read the story, because what has happened, and I'm not criticizing either side, but what's happened is the reimbursement of labor is, I think it's estimated at $80,000 a year for a production worker at these UAW plants. And that's a big amount of money. I mean, it's, you know, it's obviously important for the people working there. And it's hard work, it's dangerous work, but it's not as dangerous as it was, because we have all these safety and OSHA and all these rules. But the reality is, it's, you know, that's tough work. And, you know, people should be compensated accordingly for the amount of time and effort they put in. But keep in mind, and the classic business model is revenues minus expenses equals earnings. And expenses just went up. So in a time when the American consumer is squeezed very tight, and automobile prices are up high and car loan interest rates are high, what happens is the revenues are dropping in the automotive business. At the same time, the wages have just been negotiated up. So what, at least with the General Motors story, they're estimating somewhere between $900 and $1,000 more per automobile that the consumer will have to pay and perhaps finance as a result of the settlement. So from the labor perspective, they got a raise, that's good, and benefits, that's good. You know, your job is set for another 3 years, but the job is always dependent upon being able to sell the product. And because the labor costs have gone up, and now the estimates of the cost of the cars are going up, these companies have to compete with Kia and Toyota, and wait till the Chinese kick into full production on automobiles. And in East India, of course, you know, the Tata Motors, a big, big producer. What happens is that the big three are now out of the money with respect to the ability to produce cars that the American consumer and global consumers can afford. Their cost base is higher than because Toyota and Honda weren't you know, subject to the strike, and you know, Kia and Hyundai, those are, you know, the Korean cars are much cheaper to build, and they're good cars. I mean, you can't argue. I mean, you see a lot of them on the road, and people who want them are happy. So at the end of the day, you know, it's always the issue of killing the golden goose, and we'll see what happens with respect to the, you know, to the American automobile industry. And one thing we've noted is the whispers by the companies Ford and GM and others, and even, you know, Toyota, saying that the electronic vehicle, you know, the EV production and research and development of production, all of the big companies are dialing back on that because that's all the expense line. Now, you would tend to capitalize that as R&D. You're going to spend $2 billion to invent an electric car. All that research and development is not operating. So what they're doing is they're backing away from this, you know, inventing the future because the costs of the present are increasing. You know, raw materials increasing, fuel costs, you know, even to get all the fuel, you know, that it takes to ship stuff through the factories, all of those costs are going up. And as a result, it's putting pressure on the development of the next iteration of technology. And that's consistent. I mean, this is nothing new under the sun. If you look at the American automobile industry from back in the 1930s, all sorts of names, you know, like Nash and Rambler and Packard and all these companies that existed and no longer exist because it was their costs were too high. They were baked in, and the revenues from the sale of their products simply could not overcome the inherent institutionalized costs of operation, and they either merged or failed or went out of business. And we're always at that risk in personal transportation. So, you know, it's not, you know, you'd like to say, well, you know, the company's profits are going to suffer, but the workers will get more money. It's not a matter of, you know, squeezing a few more nickels out of the purse of the corporate treasurer. What it does is it creates this question: is can the American automobile industry survive globally when other markets have substantially lower labor costs? And the question remains to be seen. We don't know. And that's why, you know, you look at General Motors, you know, they're offshoring a lot of their production. I think the Buick brand, it's amazing. They make Buicks in China because simply it's a big market. Demand for Buicks in China is robust for cultural reasons. And it's a lot cheaper to make cars in China. So it really has an effect on the American economy over the long run. We'll see how that goes. But notwithstanding, if you UAW workers that are getting raises, then you're going to have a little bit more in your wallet or purse to defend against inflation, and that's a good thing. But the question becomes, by doing that, you've just pushed the car prices up, and that's inflation. It's a cost push. So that's another indicator that we're in a period of time when it's not the economic stability isn't 4.9% growth. Is booming, you have to ask that question. And, you know, one big question, of course, is the ability of the American consumer to continue consuming. So much pressure on the consumer, and we're seeing that in the Dallas Fed numbers, that the consumer is just in a very sad situation. And of course, we know that consumer credit card debt is up well over $1 trillion now as people are beginning to spend, you know, money cards, and that for extravagant spending, you know, the trip to the resort or something, this is basically food, clothing, and shelter and transportation. So it becomes a real problem. And you know, another indicator of stagnant consumer spending and stagnant manufacture. We were talking last Friday, I was talking about the transportation industry and how the story, I think on Friday, was that the Convoy trucking company went out of business, or at least it's heading. And I had mentioned also we had the story a few weeks ago, if not a month ago, about the Yellow Trucking Company. And unfortunately, one of the problems that you have in the trucking industry is that it's critically dependent upon this big ball of economic activity, GDP. When that's expanding, the trucking industry expands into it because, notwithstanding we're a service economy, even in a service economy, we have tangible things around us, everything from paper towels to laundry soap to steel to is hauled somewhere. Unless you happen to, it is, it just is. Even if you lived in the middle of a wheat field, you'd have to haul the wheat out to the bakery, turn it into bread, haul it back to your house. To do that. And when you see a slowdown in products being shipped hither and yon around the country, that manifests itself in lower revenues for the. And one of the big things about this convoy story that was fascinating is that that was sort of a dot-com emergent company. And the people who founded that company had this, would take a stodgy old industry like the trucking industry and turn it into a modern Uber, you know, Lyft type deal where it would all be, you know, robotic and it would all be online and it would all be very efficient. And you'd squeeze out the guy sitting in the office with the fax machine placing orders, like, you know, on a fax machine. And they tried it as hard as they could. They raised a lot of money. And frankly, what they found was that the trucking industry is very, very complex. And while you should be able to take an old-fashioned, stodgy, technologically dinosauric industry and turn it into a modern distribution, legitimate realities. And the biggest reality the trucking faces is that this decline in aggregate demand within our economy, that people are demanding less stuff. And they're demanding less stuff not because they're satiated and they're just, I'm done with stuff. No, it's because they have less money and they have less disposable income. So therefore, our ball continues to shrink a little bit. And that's why 9% growth in the, you know, GDP, when you're seeing indicator after indicator, the housing market is dead and interest rates are sky high and consumers tapped out and the Dallas Fed's telling you 18 months in a row the economy is in the tank, the trucking industry, and that doesn't really jive with the reality of that number being big. And so I think, it, you know, they put that big number out so the try and, you know, trick the FOMC, the Open Market Committee, into acting. But I just simply can't believe those people would take it because they're very intelligent people. So watch all of these numbers together and you wonder, you know, you just have to take a look at, you know, what does this all mean, you know, for the greater economy? What does it mean for you individually? And that's why when you see that savings rates are virtually on flat, 60% of Americans are falling behind, the story said, on emergency savings. And we know that our vice president has told everyone that, you know, there's very few people have $400 in savings. You know, the vast majority of Americans don't even have $400 and they're falling behind. And they're spending virtually all their take-home pay on food and energy and rent and mortgage payments and, you know, all of the consumable things. That really suggests that this idea of a growing economy is, you know, a bit illusory. And I think that's why we have to look at this stuff with a grain of salt and start asking the questions and look at those secondary tier of reported numbers, because I think that's where the story really lies. You can't just take the big headline and say, oh, the economy's doing great. Maybe it is, maybe it's not, but none of the other supporting numbers seem to point in that direction. And I think that's, you know, that's something to think about. Especially that savings number, that's rather troubling. I was talking about that last week, how you want to start to build your asset base and start to manage your assets very carefully and start thinking about how do you put your assets to work. And one thought is, if, you know, if you were to take advantage like Swiss America's deal, you know, $13.50 for just go ahead and spend those. If you put money in a savings account, it's real easy. It's linked to your treasury, your checking account, transfer the money over and it's gone. So anyway, I'll talk more about that.